We are continuing our discussion of the generation of the fathers, about 110 to 156, so the first half of the second century or so. Okay, the pastoral epistles. Epistle is a letter, in case I didn't tell you already. In the New Testament, there are three letters we call the pastoral epistles, 1st and 2nd Timothy and Titus. They originated out of a need to rein in the various diverse interpretations out there that have developed, mainly in the name of Paul. Many people were proclaiming Paul taught this and Paul taught that, which Paul didn't, okay? Or did, but other people didn't think he did, all right? So these letters are in Paul's name, and they're basically Paul refuting a lot of these new ideas, you know, like, hey, I'm Paul, and you're wrong. I never said that, and things like that, okay? By the way, these letters I told you about before when we were doing Paul that most scholars believe to be not by Paul. They're pseudo-Paul, okay? And how do we know that? Language. Well, I told you already about some of the ways we can figure out whether a letter is written by somebody or not, but a lot of it has to do with language. The content, whether it coincides with that time period or not, issues that would be of concern to that author, things like that. But anyway, the name pastoral epistles is actually a modern designation, and it stems from the fact that the letters are not addressed to churches. Usually, you know, like in Paul's letters, you get a letter addressed to the whole church. Okay, but here, they're addressed to one person. And this is a Protestant designation of these letters, and they think of the leaders of churches as pastors, okay? And Timothy and Titus are the pastors of their churches, and that's why he's writing to them, so these are pastoral epistles. But I don't know if that's the best name for them, but that's what they're called. These letters do not appear in any of the earliest collections of Paul's letters, okay? We have the earliest collection of Paul's letters that we have is from the year 200, and they're not in there. And Marcion, who we're going to talk about in a minute, he was totally into Paul, and he had a collection of Paul's letters, and these are not in them. The earliest quotation of the pastorals is from about 180, and the fellow who quotes them, Irenaeus, he does believe Paul wrote them. He looked at them, and it said by Paul, and he did believe that. But the authenticity of these letters was debated. I mean, just because he said it doesn't mean everyone believed it. There were other people who did not accept it. Okay. In fact, in some of the earliest canon lists of the New Testament, they get stuck at the end. They're not put with Paul's letters. They just get stuck on the end. All right. Well, anyway, some of the interesting differences between what you see in these letters and what you see in the letters of Paul, one of which is the portrayal of Timothy, for example. In the pastorals, Timothy is portrayed as a still very immature young man who is prone to youthful lusts and things like that, whereas in the genuine letters of Paul, he's portrayed as a very mature and trustworthy representative of God. Now, the reason why Timothy is portrayed this way is because it fits what the pastorals are trying to do. It's trying to teach him the correct ways, and you have to teach him as if he doesn't know. Also, the travels and locations mentioned in the pastorals, places where Paul goes, okay, are not mentioned in any of Paul's genuine letters or in the book of Acts. And then third, the language and tone and style of the pastorals is noticeably different from the genuine letters of Paul. So the general view now is that these were composed all together as a literary package, like a little trilogy of letters, okay, by a single author, or maybe a group of authors working together, but they were supposed to come out together. And they're kind of composed as a last will and testament of Paul, kind of consolidating his theology and attacking certain heretical groups. They're also trying to domesticate Paul. You know, in his own letters, Paul very radical, and he has some teachings that are kind of on the fringe. What the pastorals try to do is tame Paul down a little bit, make him more mainstream. So that's another thing we're going to notice about him. In Paul's own teaching, this is where he's a little bit radical, he's a little bit ascetic, he he actually encourages people not to get married. Paul does. Okay? Which is something like the Encratites in this time period would do. And the writer of the pastorals doesn't like that. Okay? He doesn't like the discouraging of marriage. Okay? So you'll see in the pastorals, Paul is kind of changed just a little bit now so that he's not so against marriage as he was in his real letters. So you'll have a passage like this in 1 Timothy. 1 Timothy 4, 1 to 4. Now the Spirit expressly says that in later times some will renounce the faith by paying attention to deceitful spirits and teachings of demons through the hypocrisy of liars whose consciences are seared with a hot iron. They forbid marriage and demand abstinence from foods which God created to be received with thanksgiving by those who believe and know the truth. For everything created by God is good, and nothing is to be rejected, provided it is received with thanksgiving. Now it's interesting that here Paul, quote unquote Paul, is giving a prophecy of what people in later times are going to say. Meaning, this time. See, so here these letters come out, right? You're reading them and it's like, oh look at Paul predicted that these Encratites are going to be around here and they're going to be saying this and look how bad it is. Right? It's similar to what we found in the letters of John the Presbyter where he talked about, you know, new ideas would come up and they would be bad. Okay? So anyway, clearly Encratites are being referred to here. The pastoral epistles present a view of Christian doctrine that is shown to be more of a tightly bound body of beliefs. Okay? He uses the Greek word paratheke, which means entrusted. He goes, I entrusted this teaching to you. It's like a package of beliefs. I'm giving these teachings to you, Timothy, and you got to take care, good care of them so that they're not changed. So here's what he says in 1 Timothy 6:20. O Timothy, guard what has been entrusted to you. Avoid the godless chatter and contradictions of what is falsely called knowledge, for by professing it, some have missed the mark as regards the faith. Interesting here, by the way, when he says something that people falsely call knowledge, but it's really not. Well, the word is gnosis. The Gnostics use the word gnosis, knowledge, as what they had. And this may be a reference to the beginnings of Gnosticism, which we're going to be talking about soon. Okay? Although knowledge can be used in other ways too, so it's not clear. But it may be a reference to the Gnostics. Okay. Anyway, this word partheke means like it's a deposit that's given in trust, and this is what he is giving to him. And he talks a lot about this. Okay, talks about faithful sayings and so on and so forth. And also it talks about Paul giving him to Timothy, right? So he is passing on a succession here. I have this body of proper doctrines. I am giving it to you, Timothy, and you take care of it. And then, of course, you're going to pass it on to the next person and make sure nothing gets changed about it. All right? So that's the concern here. In the pastorals, also, the author makes use of what we call the household duty code. What is it? Codes, household duty codes, were prevalent throughout the Greco-Roman world, even among Hellenistic Jews, by the way. And they are codes that basically embody the socioeconomic values of Roman culture. And they talk about relationships within the household, within the family. Okay, they're characterized by relationships like husbands and wives, parents and children, masters and slaves. What kind of relationships should they have in the household? Okay, and basically these codes articulate in very concrete terms the lines of authority here. Who's the boss of whom? And what the duties are of each of those categories. Okay? And we see that in the pastorals, too, the use of the household duty code. So, for example, here's what we have. This is from Titus, so you didn't read this. He says, but as for you, teach what is consistent with sound doctrine. Tell the older men to be temperate, serious, prudent, and sound in faith, in love, and in endurance. Likewise, tell the older women to be reverent in behavior, not to be slanderers or slaves to drink. They are to teach what is good so that they may encourage the young women to love their husbands, to love their children, to be self-controlled, chaste, good managers of the household, kind, being submissive to their husbands, so that the word of God may not be discredited. Likewise, urge the younger men to be self-controlled. Show yourself in all respects a model of good works, and in your teaching show integrity, gravity, and sound speech that cannot be censured. Then any opponent will be put to shame, having nothing evil to say of us. And tell slaves to be submissive to their masters. So this is typical of the household duty codes, talking about the qualities that each of the categories in the household have and their relationship with the others. Okay? We find household duty codes in the pastorals, but they're also in a couple of other letters, like 1 Peter, for example, and Ephesians and Colossians, which are a couple of those that we're not sure are by Paul. But anyway, showing the ideal household. Okay? Now, he says, why? So that no one will have anything evil to say about us. So something that they're concerned about in Christianity is we want to make sure that we have fine, upstanding families that the Romans can look at and say, oh, they're good people. So there's some concern about that. The hierarchical church offices are mentioned in Timothy. You probably read that. And they're modeled after the family. In other words, the positions in the church are like a family. You've got a dad and so on and so forth. Still, though, there doesn't seem to be a separation between bishops and presbyters yet. In this particular letter, they seem to be the same. Actually, I don't think presbyters are even mentioned. It might just mention bishops and deacons, and that's it, which suggests that maybe presbyters and bishops are the same thing. Okay, but he says that the offices are held by males. He's very clear about that. The offices are for men. All right? And the women are supposed to listen to them. This is a far cry from the free flow of charismatic expression and leadership of women in the house churches that we saw in the days of Paul. For example, here's what he says. Deacons, likewise, are to be men, worthy of respect, sincere, not indulging in much wine, and not pursuing dishonest gain. A deacon must be the husband of but one wife and must manage his children and his household well. Okay. Now we get some interesting things here also about women. So this is in 1 Timothy 2. Maybe you noticed this. He says, I desire then also that the women should dress themselves modestly and decently in suitable clothing, not with their hair braided or with gold, pearls, or expensive clothes, but with good works, as is proper for women who profess reverence for God. Let a woman learn in silence with full submission. I permit no woman to teach or to have authority over a man. She is to keep silent. For Adam was formed first, then Eve, and Adam was not deceived, but the woman was deceived and became a transgressor. Yet she will be saved through childbearing, provided they continue in faith and love and holiness with modesty. That's going a little bit further than Paul ever went about the role of women. Interesting that she is to keep quiet and learn, let the men teach her. And the reason is, and he uses from the Bible, from Adam and Eve, that Eve was the one who was deceived. I guess the implication is women are easily deceived or something like that. But anyway, that's what he feels. Okay? So he draws a very clear picture about the subordination of women in the church. There was, in the Greco-Roman world, a belief that women were more easily tempted than men. Okay, it was just a common thing in the Greco-Roman world that women can be easily led astray, they can be easily tricked, fooled. All right. So it's very much, it's not like he's being innovative here. It's very much in keeping with the times. Okay, what he's saying is reflecting traditional Roman values. He says this. This is in 1 Timothy 5, talking about young widows. He says, they learn to be idle, gadding about from house to house. And they are not merely idle, but also gossips and busybodies, saying what they should not say. All right? And he's worried that they get out of hand here. They could get into trouble. Okay, so he didn't like the fact that they didn't have much to do. So how are they saved? Through good works and through childbearing, keeps them busy, okay, so that they don't get into trouble. The problem, first and foremost for him, though, seems to be he doesn't want women teaching men. Okay, that's why he tells them to learn in silence. The men should be teaching the women, and that's why, for him, the men have the positions of authority in the house, or in the church. Okay, regional church networks. I have a map here. I don't have a map. I guess I have this. Okay, in Paul's day, a couple generations ago, there was talk about hospitality for traveling missionaries, you know, and there was an arrangement set up where if a missionary shows up, you'll take care of them. And we even say that in the Didache, too, in the second generation, where prophets show up, traveling people show up, and the church is supposed to take care of them. But there were no established links between the churches. You might have some visitor come in from out of town, and you're like, oh, where are you from? Oh, what's it like there? You know, you don't know, all right? Because there's no formal links between the churches. Now, you get a little more of that in the next generation when you get to, like, Ignatius. He sent letters to a bunch of different churches, right? Not all of them, but a few. You get someone like Clement, I told you about, who was in Rome, who wrote to Corinth. So you're getting communications like that, all right? So there's a growing network of relations between regions here. But still, it's very primitive, and we shouldn't think that, you know, a Christian on one side of the Mediterranean could call up one on the phone, and see how things are going in his church. That didn't really happen that often, okay? But anyway, there were several axes, I guess you could say, or vectors of kind of church alliances, little interlocking circles, I guess you might say, of areas that were in more contact with one another than with other areas. So, for example, what I'm saying here, the city of Antioch, over there on the right, see up there? Near Syria. It's actually in Syria. Antioch and Eastern Turkey and Western Asia Minor were all in pretty decent contact with one another. So that's like a little network right there. They had more communication with each other than they had outside of that territory. All right. Another axis would be Greece and Rome. You know, Italy and Greece. They tended to be in contact with one another, as well as Asia Minor. There were a bunch of churches in Asia Minor that were in communication with one another. Those are the types of networks that we see. There was another network in Egypt. Okay, they communicated with each other around Egypt. Alexandria was pretty much the center of that. Okay, and as you might guess, over here in North Africa, there was another one, and then there would be one up there in Gaul. Okay, so what I'm saying is, they may have been able to communicate with nearby churches on a more regular basis than with ones farther away. So you didn't hear about what was going on elsewhere as much. Okay? And each of these networks tended to have their own literary and theological trajectory. In Asia Minor, for example, Paul literature was popular, but even more so during this period, John literature was very popular. Okay, in Italy, Paul literature was popular, and so was Peter literature. So in various regions, you would have certain literature that would be more popular there. Okay, and that's why I mentioned about the Gospels, too. Certain Gospels were liked in certain regions more than other Gospels. And that's how you get a diversity of different scriptures. Okay, some of them are going to make it into the New Testament, and other ones won't. In light of the theological controversies that came later, in the latter half of the second century, these networks and their ability to interact became extremely important in the development of a normative consensus. If you want to get a consensus as to how things should be done or what we should believe, you have to have the communication. Okay? That's why in these various networks, in a certain region, they would tend to do things very similarly to one another because they were in better communication with one another. But the people that they weren't in constant communication with might have had a different kind of way of doing things. So there's still lots of diversity here, but there's more of an attempt to consolidate, to find a norm, but it's happening still rather locally. Marcion of Sinope. Sinope, well, I might as well go back to the map. is it, see up there near the Black Sea, Pontus? There's a little city there called Sinope. That's where he's from. All right, so he's from Asia Minor. He's actually in the vicinity where Pliny was governor. He may have even been alive there because we know that Marcion's father was a Christian. All right, so his father was, by the way, a wealthy ship owner. Okay, and Marcion inherited the business. Sinope was the chief port there in Pontus, so they made a lot of money. So who knows? Maybe Marcion was aware of what Pliny was doing or whatever. But he was raised a Christian, okay? And his father may have been a bishop, although we're not sure. Then around the year 120 or so, he moves to Ephesus, which is, well, let's go back here. It's in Asia Minor on the western coast. I don't know if you can see it there, kind of in the near the south, Ephesus. So he moves down there to Ephesus. And there he studied a lot about Paul. He was very interested in the Apostle Paul. So he studied all the letters of Paul. And we're talking about, you know, the ones in the original collection, not the pastorals. Okay. And he tried to gain a leadership position in the church there, it is said. But people were already finding fault with some of his views. And Polycarp was there at the time. Polycarp was in the neighborhood. And Polycarp, this is a legend, okay? But it is said that Marcion met Polycarp. And Marcion said, "Do you know me?" And Polycarp said, "Yes, you're the firstborn of Satan." But that's because the later views of Marcion will be very negative. Well, even contemporary views will be negative of him. So it's possible that Polycarp said something like that, but it's probably just a little propaganda. But anyway, Marcion then left Ephesus and went to Rome in the 130s. And there he had a little bit more success, although he ran into some problems. He was initially welcomed there because he's rich and he gave a very large contribution to the Roman church. And he set up a school there, a Christian school, like to teach theology. And he began to teach there, and he wrote a lot about his own ideas. And as the story goes, he presented some of his writings to the presbyters of the church at Rome, and they didn't like them. And they rejected his ideas. And so he was expelled from the Roman church around 144. But some people liked his ideas, and they went with him. And after that, he continued to preach and began setting up churches of his own that taught his theology, and he attracted quite a substantial following over the next decade or so, and not just in Italy, but all throughout the Mediterranean. We have evidence of Marcionite churches in Egypt, in Palestine, in Arabia, in Syria, in Asia Minor, and even in Persia outside the Roman Empire. Okay, they were very well organized, and they had their own bishops and everything. Okay. Now, Marcion, he had a chief work, and it was called the Antitheses. And in it, he laid out in columns the differences between the God of the Old Testament and the God of the New Testament. That was because his belief was that the God of the Old Testament, the Jewish God, is not the true God. He's an inferior God and not the true good God. Okay? So he would lay out like passages from the Hebrew Scriptures and put passages from the Gospels and stuff like that and from Paul on the other side, and he would show the difference between the two gods to demonstrate that really we should be worshiping the God of Jesus and not the God of the Jews. Okay? He was very much against the Old Testament, and he didn't think that any of the Jewish scriptures should be accepted. Okay? He went on to say that Jesus is not the Jewish Messiah. Okay? The Messiah is supposed to be this, that, and the other thing. Jesus wasn't that. He's not the Jewish Messiah. He should not be identified with the Jewish Messiah. He's better than that. Okay? And he says any of these other Christian groups that tell you about Jesus fulfilling all these scriptures and everything from the Old Testament, that's all wrong. Okay? Because that's not about him at all. He was also a Docetist. Told you about Docetism before. He believed that Jesus was entirely a spiritual being who inhabited a human body, and then he departed it before he was crucified. So he didn't really die. Okay? He was always a spirit. But anyway, Marcion was the first that we know of in history to actually talk about what should go into a scriptural canon for Christians. You know, thinking about it, if he doesn't accept the Hebrew Bible, all right, what's his Bible? He's got to have a Bible, right? So he began developing a Christian Bible. And we believe it's because of his idea to develop a Christian Bible that other Christians got on the bandwagon and said, well, we don't like your choice of books there, so we're going to have a better Christian Bible. And so that's how the whole got the whole thing going. All right, but let me tell you what was in his Bible. First of all, he upheld the teachings of Paul. He very much believed in Paul. He liked Paul's Hellenizer position, but he's even more extreme than Paul. Okay, just discard Judaism altogether was Marcion's view. He rejected the Gospels of Matthew, Mark, John. He had a gospel, okay, that's similar to Luke, but from what we can tell, he didn't like Luke either. All right. Some people say that he just doctored up Luke, but it appears to have been a different gospel. Okay, he called it the gospel of Paul. Now, we don't believe Paul even wrote a gospel, but he says this is Paul's gospel. Okay, it's probably a collection of sayings that were in use among some of the churches that liked Paul and had some of Paul's sayings and maybe what Paul said about Jesus' life and so on and so forth. And that's how he collected it. But it was a gospel, supposedly, by Paul. Okay? And then he had all of Paul's letters, but not the pastorals. He had Paul's letters and he called it the Apostolicon. That would be the group of letters of Paul. That's basically was his Bible. No Old Testament at all. Just that. Gospel and letters of Paul. That's it. Okay? And and that's their Bible. Those are their sacred scriptures. Now, the later followers of Marcion, you know, evolved somewhat. So after his death, you'll have Marcionites for quite some time. And they will begin making a move towards Gnosticism. And we'll talk more about Gnosticism next time. But we're going to see that they move away from Marcion just a little bit to become more Gnostic. Okay, he was not really a Gnostic. But they will become more like that. And as I tell you about Gnosticism next time, then you'll understand what I mean. Okay, but I'll just tell you that right now. They also became much more ascetic over time. They adopted a number of enkritite ways. Okay, not all Marcionites did, but a lot of them did become kind of like, well, they abstained from marriage and they didn't drink alcohol and they didn't eat meat and so on. Okay, interestingly, we have a very ancient Christian inscription. It's dated to the 300s, okay, but it's over a doorway of a house in a village in Syria, and it's where a Marcionite church used to be. And on the inscription it says, dedicated to the Lord and Savior Jesus, the good Christos, with an E. Okay? And the reason being is, the Marcionites rejected the word Christos, which is meaning Messiah. And they said, oh, no, the other churches, they're mispronouncing it. They corrupted the original word. It wasn't really Christ. It wasn't really Christos. It was Christos, which means a holy man or something like that. It's a great title. Okay, it's like perfect or saint or something like that. And he's Jesus Christ, not Jesus Christ. Okay, so anyway, that's another little idiosyncrasy of the Marcionites. One might easily get the impression that the second century saw the Christian movement growing more isolated from the Roman culture as it was getting more visible. But actually, that's not really true. Okay, the martyr literature makes it seem like that. Whenever you read things about the martyrs and how the Romans persecuted the Christians, then you get the impression like, oh, well, they're kind of trying to stay away from Romans. But there are other writings that are not like that at all. Okay, and mainly I'm talking about the writings of the apologists. Okay, the term apology is a technical term in Greek. It actually comes from Greek law. It means a defense speech in court. So it's not like the apologists are apologizing. You know, we're really sorry that we're Christians and everything. It's not like that at all. Okay, they're giving defenses of Christianity. It's a defense speech. Okay, the classical form of the apology goes back to Demosthenes in ancient Athens, who gave this first kind of speeches like that. But a really good example would be Plato's Apology. I don't know if anyone ever read Plato's Apology. It's about the trial of Socrates, and Socrates gives his defense speech in court, right? That's what these are like, okay? But anyway, it became a kind of an interesting genre that not just pagans used, but also even Jews and Christians, especially during this period. And you're trying to defend yourself before the authorities, like you're in court. Okay, there was a considerable amount of persecution here. I mean, not like it's going to be later. Later is going to be lots. But here, you know, sporadic persecution here and there. And Christians were being martyred and things like that. So, it's a reason to want to defend yourself. So the typical Christian apologist was usually a very highly educated intellectual. Okay, who considered himself part of the Hellenistic cultural elite of the time. But he's a Christian, okay? So they're writing to provide a rational description of Christianity that the educated pagan could understand. They want to dispel the gossip about Christianity. They want to rebut the charges that have been lodged against Christianity. And they also want to demonstrate the superiority of Christianity by comparing it with other religions. Now, the apologists don't all agree about how to do that. They all do it different ways. Some of them go on the attack. Others are more defensive. And some of them are more open to Greco-Roman ideas, and some of them not so much. Okay, but anyway, the apologies that were written during this period were addressed to the Roman ruling class. Several apologies were actually even addressed to the Roman emperor. So, for example, Justin's first apology was addressed to Antoninus Pius, Roman emperor. There's another guy, Athenagoras, no one you need to remember, but he addressed his to Marcus Aurelius. All right? But we think it's a literary device. It is unlikely that the Roman emperor actually read this. Okay? We don't think that it was even sent to the Roman emperor or to any of these officials that it mentions because it's part of the genre. Okay? The real audience would have been Christians. And why? Because it's trying to show Christians how they can defend their faith to other people. Some of them are even written in dialogue form, like having a conversation with a Jew or a pagan or something like that, trying to show how Christianity is better. And so it's a way for Christians to read it and say, oh, these are good, I've got to use these. You know? But the genre is you address it to a Roman official or something like that. The kind of issues that were treated by these apologists came from two different perspectives. One was, what about all the popular rumors and gossip and suspicions that were being spread about Christianity? We've got to address those. So that was one area that they would be concerned about. The other area was from philosophical criticism. So, for example, the most famous pagan writer who wrote against Christians from a philosophical point of view during this period was a guy named Celsus. And you know what? I think I even may mention him later, because I think he comes just a little bit later. But anyway, we'll talk about him again. He wrote a treatise against Christianity. Okay? He talks about the absurdity of Christian beliefs and things like that. And so the apologists will then respond. They'll say, oh, well, I got an answer to that. And so they'll have a defense from a philosophical point of view. But a pagan didn't have to write something in order for them to write this. Sometimes they did it just because things that were going around. Okay? All right, so let me tell you about Justin. He's probably the best known of all the apologists. He's called Justin Martyr because he obviously wasn't called that during his lifetime because he was martyred, okay? But he was born around the year 100 or so to a pagan family. And it was in Palestine, and he took a pilgrimage to Athens, and he wanted to learn all about philosophy, and he went to school there. And he traveled a lot of the great cities of the empire and learned a lot about Greco-Roman philosophy. he saw a number of martyrdoms of Christians. He went to some of the, you know, sometimes when they had them thrown into the beast or whatever, he'd check it out, or if they killed him or whatever, he'd look at some of these. And then he went to Rome about 140 and converted to Christianity, and he now wants to present it from a philosophical point of view to show that it, hey, Christianity is for intellectuals too. Because, you know, it had a reputation for not, you know, for being for stupid people, okay? He wants to make it clear that, no, it's for smart people, okay, like me. So that's why he wrote these, okay? He actually established his own school of philosophy at Rome, right around the same time as Marcion, by the way. The two of them didn't like each other, okay? And Justin had students there, and he taught Christian philosophy. And he debates a lot with some of the philosophers from Rome of that period. He did that apart from his writings. Now, there is a work called The Acts of Justin, which was written later, about Justin. So, clearly, there's legends in here. Okay, but it does say that his Christian school was in a rented apartment on the upper floor of a large urban bath complex, which tells us a little something here. So when I tell you that he opened a school, I don't mean he had people construct a nice university or something like that, and that's he's teaching at a school that has a special school building. His school was in an upstairs room on top of some baths. Okay, so it's not like it's something special. Okay, that's what we mean when we say Marcion or Justin opened a school. That's kind of what we're talking about here, just so you can understand what we mean. Okay, but he wrote two works. They're two apologies, I should say. He wrote other works too. They're called the First Apology and the Second Apology. Anyway, the Second Apology is pretty much just a reiteration of the first one. So if you read Justin's First Apology, the whole thing, you wouldn't really have to read a second one because it's pretty much the same thing. He tries to show that belief in Jesus' death and resurrection is really no different than pagan beliefs. Say, oh, you make fun of us for our beliefs? You have beliefs that are the same thing. And then he'd talk about that. He says, so really, we're the same. He likes using that kind of argument. Some of the apologists aren't like that. Some of them are like, we're better than you. Justin likes to do it like, we're the same. Okay? So, you believe that, I believe this. It's the same thing. You know, this is the way he presents it. So, here's an example. He says, in saying that the Logos, who is the first offspring of God, was born for us without sexual union, as Jesus Christ our teacher, and that he was crucified and died, and after rising again, ascended into heaven, we introduce nothing new beyond what you say of those whom you call sons of Zeus. You know how many sons of Zeus the writers whom you honor speak of? Hermes, the hermeneutic Logos and teacher of all, Asclepius, who was also a healer, and after being struck by lightning, ascended into heaven, as did Dionysus, who was torn in pieces. He's talking about resurrections too. Heracles, who would escape his torments, threw himself into the fire. And he goes on and on and on to mention all these figures from mythology. And what about your deceased emperors, whom you regularly think worthy of being raised to immortality, summoning as witness one who swears to have seen the cremated Caesar ascending into heaven from the funeral pyre? But the Son of God, who is called Jesus, even if only an ordinary human, is worthy to be called Son of God because of his wisdom. Now, he's not saying he believes he was only an ordinary human, but he's saying from their perspective, you should be willing to call him Son of God just for the fact that he was such a wise man. Okay? Why do you have a problem with the word son, you know, phrase Son of God? And if we say, as we said before, that he, peculiarly in comparison to an ordinary birth, was born from God as the Logos of God, such should be ordinary to you who call Hermes the angelic Logos proceeding from God. See how he's trying to show that, you know, you believe a lot of the same stuff we do. So what is the problem? In his apology, Justin gives a very interesting picture of Christian worship at the time that I wanted to read because it tells you a little bit more about what's going on in a church meeting or whatever. And here's what he says. It's a little long, but I'll read. I'll just take out the boring parts. Okay, I will explain the manner in which we have dedicated ourselves to God, having been renewed through Christ, so that we will not appear pernicious by leaving something out of the exposition. He's talking about people who believe the Christians. He says, They are led by us to a place where there is water, and they are reborn in the same manner of regeneration by which we ourselves have been reborn. He's talking about baptism. And after thus washing, the one who has been persuaded and who has assented, then we lead him to those who are called brothers in the place where they regularly assemble. We finish our prayers and salute one another with a kiss. The bread and a cup containing water and wine are brought to the president of the brethren. And taking them, he offers praise and glory to the Father of all through the name of the Son and the Holy Spirit, and he gives thanks at length for being judged worthy of these things by him. When the president has given thanks and the whole congregation has assented, those who are called deacons by us give to each one present a portion of the bread and water mixed with wine. Interesting that their wine for the Eucharist is mixed with water. But it was common, by the way, in those days to put water in your wine. Then they take it to those who were not present at the assembly. And on the day that is called the Day of the Sun, that's Sunday, there is a meeting together in one place of all who dwell in cities or the country. So their main meeting's on Sunday already. It's kind of interesting. As long as time permits, the memoirs of the apostles or the writings of the prophets are read. So apostolic writings and the prophets would be Old Testament, right? When the reader has finished, the president gives exhortation in a discourse and an invitation to imitate these good things. Then we all rise up in unison and offer prayers. And as we said before, when we have finished praying, bread is brought and wine with water. The president offers prayers and thanksgiving in the same manner to the best of his ability, and the congregation assents by saying the Amen. Now, a lot of these features are clearly recognizable from later Christian practice, but the informality with which he describes it is kind of refreshing when you think about it. Like, it's very kind of down-homey, you know, it's not like, you know, it's not real formal, okay? It's still taking place in people's homes. We don't have any, archaeologically, we have not found any church buildings from this period. So that's Justin. He was brought up on charges in Rome, apparently for his Christianity, and he died in 164. Okay, we'll leave it at that. We'll see you on Thursday.